and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou, and joined in studio by our longtime host, Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the high-stakes intrigue in Saudi Arabia continues as Saudi citizens are instructed to leave Lebanon immediately, and the Lebanese prime minister continues to be held in what some are speculating is house arrest. Is another war around the corner? Next, a new study from Brown University has found that the total cost of the so-called war on terror amounts to an eye-popping $5.6 trillion. That's $23,386 per taxpayer. Then, the Trump administration is tightening the screws on the U.S. blockade of Cuba, prohibiting additional transactions in its drive to reverse the thaw in U.S.-Cuban relations that began at the end of the Obama presidency. And finally, NATO is growing yet again. The alliance's defense ministers decided yesterday to create two new commands, including one focused on naval operations in the Atlantic. But first, we turn to the situation in Saudi Arabia and Lebanon. We are joined from Philadelphia by Redwan Shahab. He is a political analyst focusing on the Middle East. Welcome, Redwan.
Hello, everyone. Pleased to be here.
So the developments have been moving so fast in Saudi Arabia and Lebanon over the past few days. And now we see that Saudi Arabia is instructing its citizens in Lebanon to leave the country. What do you make of that development?
So this is part of, in a lot of ways, part of historically part of what Saudi Arabia tends to do in terms of its gambit of tools that it employs against a lot of their guest workers from countries that are particularly vulnerable to this. So like in the 1990s, when the Palestinian Authority sided with Saddam Hussein, they employed a similar strategy where they basically expelled all Palestinian guest workers as a way to pressure political parties at home in Palestine. So this is not surprising. What is somewhat surprising is that Kuwait and other regional players in the Gulf are following suit.
Yeah, so in other words, this isn't necessarily what you're saying, sort of a prelude to a war, possibly. I mean, I think that's sort of how it's being read by a lot of people. Well, Saudi Arabia doesn't want its citizens to be embroiled in violence. So, I mean, how would you assess the possibility of some kind of like imminent military action taking place in Lebanon that's related to the Saudi intervention there?
I think it's unlikely that we're to see any sort of conflict related to like direct Saudi intervention. Saudi Arabia is known for, you know, despite having very large military budgets, they are not well known for fighting their own wars. So it's unlikely, if there is to be conflict, that Saudi Arabia would be, you know, committing any troops to Lebanon. I think, you know, in the minds of many Lebanese analysts, you know, if there is to be some sort of conflict, it would probably come at the coaxing of Saudi Arabia to Israel, you know, who, you know, there is a domestic sort of political will for perhaps another conflict with Hezbollah, but in terms of in Israel. But outside of that, I don't see any sort of, you know, interventionism relative to like Saudi planes flying over Beirut or something. That I think is unlikely.
According to media sources, the arrests of dozens of Saudi royal figures in the last week, ministers, businessmen, is just the start of what is being characterized by the government as an anti-corruption drive. What's your view of what's going on inside of Saudi Arabia? It's kind of a war inside the royal family. Is it the beginning of a larger family-wide purge? And what's the goal?
I mean, since Mohammed bin Salman, sort of like his father, took over, and he sort of, you know, began consolidating power, because this is the important thing to remember, you know, in 2015, when he kind of rose to prominence, he's been sort of moving and jockeying himself into this position of, you know, being the sole power broker in Saudi Arabia, whereas historically most I guess, power structures in Saudi Arabia were broken up among different elements of the family. So, you know, having bin Talal and all these other important figures inside of Saudi media or even Middle East media generally, because I believe bin Talal has significant shares in Rotana, which is, you know, one of the largest media companies in the Middle East. You know, having arrested them and now being able to seize their assets, you know, this is in large part, you know, basically removing any sort of domestic threat to, you know, his own power. The other thing to keep in mind is, you know, Saudi Arabia has a history of this sort of behavior, not necessarily to top princes, but there are many like junior level princes, you know, over the decades, you know, even a couple years ago, that have gone missing. Or there was one, I cannot remember his name off the top of my head, but there was one in Switzerland where he was kind of whisked away onto a Saudi jet and brought back to Riyadh, you know, after being quite critical of the regime. So these things happen, you know, at least in terms of like palace or family, inter-family intrigue, you know, happens more often than not. So I think in this case, you know, it's just the number of family members that have been grabbed, and as well as the profile of them is what is so concerning. You know, we're going from a kingdom probably closer to, you know, in some ways a sultanate, right, where, you know, single sort of rule and no reference or no deference to any other family members.
Let's turn now to what's going on inside of Lebanon. I mean, first of all, do we even know where Prime Minister Hariri is? Can anybody get in contact with him? And tell me what that means for Lebanese society. I mean, it seems to me to be like a really shocking violation of Lebanese sovereignty and independence.
Well, you know, what's interesting to keep in mind is that Prime Minister Saad al-Hariri, right, he is a Saudi citizen. And so for, you know, for many Lebanese, there's always been sort of a question regarding his loyalties. Also, the other thing to keep in mind is there are some, and it's interestingly enough, his domestic opponents, Hezbollah and Amal, they have been questioning, you know, or rather demanding his release. But I think what's more likely is that, you know, despite the fact that he more than likely is being held against his will, the other thing to keep in mind is his businesses, I believe the group is its Ogre Group, they've been struggling financially for a few years now. And I think, you know, it would make sense that Saad al-Hariri is going to be driven by, you know, an attempt to basically salvage his companies. You know, there's a lot of leverage that the Saudi king has over, the king and the crown prince are holding over him. And insofar as you know, Lebanese, I guess like Lebanese demand for their prime minister to come back, you know, or where he is. I know he was in the UAE, I believe, yesterday, and there was rumors that he was supposed to come back to Lebanon, but I don't think at the moment that is likely to happen.
Walter, it's interesting that the princes and businessmen who are being arrested, they're being kept at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh. All the hotel guests were told, get your stuff, assemble in the lobby. Then they took them out, and now there's no more vacancies at the hotel because that's the prison.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's typical Saudi stuff.
Yeah, it is surprising. And the people who they're like, Prince Alawid is a billionaire. I mean, he's so economically important to the country. Redwan, I want to go back to the point that you were making about Saad Hariri, the prime minister of Lebanon, who's perhaps in Saudi Arabia, perhaps in the UAE. So his businesses were struggling. Am I correct in understanding that that's partially because the Saudi economy had been going downhill because of the decline in oil prices?
So yes and no, right? So it is connected to the fact that the Saudi, business sector relative to construction, because his company is a construction company. They were struggling because of that overall, the slowdown in the economy. There's also the fact that there were supposed to be large contracts that were to be awarded to his company, I believe in 2014, 2015. And there was a, ironically, there was an audio recording that got out around that same time of Saad al-Hariri criticizing the family member in particular, but I believe he was criticizing in general the like Saudi family for their stalling relative to providing the contracts. And in essence, those contracts were then withdrawn, and it's severely damaged his company's bottom line, and they've been struggling for some time. So that is, I think, you know, for the average, you know, viewer of this conflict, and even for the average Lebanese, that's important to keep in mind. The other thing to keep in mind too is the Saudis, I believe that they are miscalculating when it comes to the value that Saad al-Hariri provides them in terms of destabilizing the Lebanese government. His party has not really had the consensus of the Sunni community in Lebanon for quite a few years. You know, when he first took the prime minister position directly after his father's death, there was sort of a mandate within the community, but he has proven to not be a very effective politician during his first stint as prime minister. In his second stint, this was seen almost as a gimme, and he's been a very different sort of politician as a result. So I think the idea that the Saudis maybe had thought that they were going to sow some sort of insurrection or you know social conflict as a result of this, I don't think that is ultimately, I believe, going to backfire for them, which is why it makes it so dangerous relative to whether or not they're just going to go with, you know, a Qatar-style boycott of Lebanon, or if it's going to be something more direct, you know, them leaning on Israel or something like this.
Redwan, there are elections coming up in Lebanon in a few months, I believe, and I know that you are planning on voting in those elections. How do you think this whole drama, this whole scenario is going to affect the Lebanese elections? We have just a little bit under 2 minutes left.
Those elections were supposed to come up, I believe, sometime either next spring or next summer. But they were registering people internationally now in lieu of them. This could be directly damaging for those elections, you know, where if the Lebanese government decides that they can't find a replacement for Saad al-Hariri, then more than likely they'll do what they've been doing, which is postponing elections and just keeping the status quo, which is, you know, extremely damaging to Lebanese, you know, the average Lebanese person's ability to get effective benefits from their government or any sort of new construction or any sort of, you know, expecting your government to work. It won't work if it's operating off of budgets that are way out of whack and so on and so forth.
That's just about all the time we have. We've been joined from Philadelphia by Redwan Shahab. He is a political analyst focusing on the Middle East. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back. You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
A new study from Brown University has found that the total cost of the so-called war on terror amounts to an eye-popping $5.6 trillion. That's $23,386 per U.S. taxpayer. We're joined from New York by Ted Rall. He is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. Welcome, Ted.
Thanks.
Ted, don't you think we have to get big government out of our lives, off of our backs?
I think that right-wing conservatives have a point when they say that government wastes a lot of money, and this is a classic example.
But they're not talking about the Pentagon.
No, they never mean the Pentagon, even though it's by far the biggest expense in the federal budget. And you know what no one ever talks about either is debt service on previous wars. Like, that's massive. If you include that, it's 54% of all spending, federal spending, is military spending.
Do you feel safer, though?
Well, you know, I didn't really feel like I was in that much danger to begin with, right? I mean, we've got two friendly nations on our southern and northern borders, and two giant oceans on either side of us. You know, the U.S. is in a pretty good neighborhood when it comes to fear of being invaded. There's not much chance of that.
We were invaded in 1812.
Oh, I guess you could argue during World War II, right, when the Japanese occupied some of the Aleutian Islands.
Yeah.
The balloons that were sent over filled with explosives, 1942, I think.
They killed a Boy Scout, right?
Yeah. Terrifying. So $5.6 trillion, that's a huge amount of money, but it also represents like a political choice that people are making because, you know, every dollar that they spend on bombs and bullets and other things that kill people, that could be spent on infrastructure. It could be spent on healthcare. It could be spent on education. Talk about that.
Well, I mean, obviously, yeah, it's a matter of budgetary priorities. I mean, you compare yourself or compare us to, say, Greenland, which has no standing army and obviously no defense budget. Now, obviously, the United States is a different country than Greenland, which isn't, I think, even technically its own country. But it is still it is a fact that the United States spends more than every other country combined on military spending, that we're by far the world's largest arms exporter. I mean, this is a decision that we made some time ago to make this a giant part of our economy and of our value system. And it's, it's the reason that the United States ranks so low on so many standard quality of life indices, whether it's infant mortality or the state of the education system, healthcare, and so on. And it's a tremendous waste of money. I mean, the point of the military should be to keep the U.S. homeland safe. And apparently, as we saw in 9/11, the military is not very good at that. And at the same time, it seems like it's almost all outwardly directed towards aggression against other countries, which only makes us more unsafe because it creates so many new enemies that we didn't have in the first place. So it is actually madness. And it's, it's insane to live in a country that spends trillions of dollars on war when you have people who are homeless and are sleeping outside and people die of diseases that they could have treated. I mean, it's insane. And that's where we live.
You know, the war on terror label for this study is actually misleading. We were playing around with it a little bit in the beginning of this interview. But what the Brown University study is, the so-called war on terror study, it's Washington has expended a whopping $5.6 trillion on wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and Pakistan since 2001. That's what they're talking about. That doesn't count the wars, the drone strikes, the military operations that are going on in Africa and elsewhere. The war in Iraq was not part of the war on terror. I mean, the war on terror was a slogan under which all military operations were carried out. The war in Syria, that was the covert operation by the U.S. CIA along with Turkey and Qatar and Saudi Arabia to break up a country, a government that the United States was at peace with. So, of course, was Iraq, a country that was at peace with the United States. In the case of Afghanistan, al-Qaeda was basically driven from the country by November 2001. The Taliban fled immediately, like within days from the central government, even though the Taliban had never carried out attacks against the United States or Western targets. So this is a little bit misleading, actually, this kind of slide. I mean, if we're really talking about what the war on terror has cost the American tax dollars, it's actually a whole lot more than $5.6 trillion broken out, of course, into the $23,386 per U.S. taxpayer. I mean, we're spending a whole lot more than that. Always, again, using the war on terror as a brand more than a war on terror.
Yes, as they call it in the government, GWAT, Global War on Terror, is their official acronym. And it's, there's been all these statistics about how far more Americans are killed by falling Coke machines and televisions or by struck by lightning than are killed by terrorism. And even when you include self-radicalized Islamists like the guy who ran over the bicyclists in Lower Manhattan, even when you include all those numbers, I mean, the fact is it's horrible when it happens to you or to someone you know. But the fact is, this is not a major cause of death or injury in the United States in a country of 330 million people. It just isn't. We should be a lot more concerned still about things like secondhand smoke and encouraging people to use their seatbelts.
And one more thing, 54% of the perpetrators of mass shootings in the United States, and a mass shooting is defined as shooting four or more people in one incident, 54% of those perpetrators have been involved in what the government is now euphemistically calling prior domestic abuse, which means violence against women. So you have 54% of the people who are carrying out mass shootings in the United States. And we saw this again in Texas with the terrible massacre in the Baptist church. Men who are terrorists against women. And in the United States government or the society doesn't label violence against women as terrorism, even though there is really a pandemic of violence against women.
Well, I think in fairness to them, terrorism is officially defined as violence carried out toward a political end. And that's obviously people beating up their wives and their children is not a political act, generally speaking. But, the point still remains that it's really serious. I mean, look, people freak out from the terrorist label. We've just been an insane country ever since 9/11. And it's a little puzzling because countries that have had far more experience with terrorism, I mean, for example, France and England were subject respectively to Islamist attacks throughout the 1980s and also by the IRA. They carried on and kept calm for the most part. Same thing in Israel, where they have an experience of political violence that has pretty much followed them for most of the state's existence. Life goes on. People don't freak out. Although right-wing politics obviously are far more popular than they would be otherwise. I think it's Americans are coddled, you know? I mean, we're so used to feeling safe that we feel like violence is something that we do to others. It's not supposed to be something that happens to us. We're just international bullies, and spending all this protection money on the military makes us feel good, I think, or it makes the country feel okay. But it is insane, and lots of people have pointed it out. And yet it's like guns. Nothing changes.
You know, Ted, I want to go back to the question of the violence against women, not because I don't disagree with you that a political terrorism or terrorism is usually connected to a political goal. But my point really was this, and it's sort of what you were coming back to. We are calm about some things and whipped into an absolute hysteria about other things. And the routine, regular, and systematic levels of violence against women, which is, you know, again, 54% of the perpetrators of mass shootings in the United States, as compared to, say, quote, explicitly terrorist acts, are perpetrated by men who are engaged in violence against women. And the country really does treat these events as sort of bad things and sad things and tragic things. But there's not like a call to arms to do something about it to, quote, keep the country safe, where clearly big parts of the country are not safe right now. And the government is directing people's money to spend, for military contracts and military bases and weapons of all sorts. But in other words, if we really look at issues of security in the country and try to compare what is the risk here and what is the risk there, it seems to me that this is a very self-serving orientation for the U.S. government. It could orient the country to say, look, we really have an alarming problem, a problem that's costing a lot of Americans their lives, and it's this, not that.
I mean, you're right. I mean, in that sense, the women who you're referencing, they are terrorized. And, you know, what could possibly be more horrifying than being afraid to go home because your husband might hurt you in your own house you're still not safe. I mean, it's anyone who's ever been near or a victim of domestic violence knows how incredibly terrifying that is. And, you know, we don't even bother to go so far. Forget about military spending. There aren't even public service announcements or billboards by the Ad Council calling for offering assistance, counseling, safe houses, encouraging people to turn batterers over to the police, encouraging for prosecution. This is not something that our op-ed pages focus on. It's just considered part of the scenery. It's just something that happens. It's like homelessness. If you live in a big city, you step over homeless people on your way to work. If you're lucky enough to have a job, and you just think that's just normal, but it's normative, but it's not normal.
Right, right. And the media could make it abnormal and alert consciousness and create consciousness and have it be like a mobilization of public opinion against this or that danger instead of what we're focused on here. According to this Brown study, Walter, by 2056, a conservative estimate is that interest costs will be about $8 trillion, unless the U.S. changes the way it pays for wars. I mean, this is like draining the national treasury, as Ted and you were talking about, draining the national treasury and subsidizing those that make weapons. And again, they need to have the war on terror as a pretext. It's very helpful. It incentivizes this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, so we're talking about this Watson Institute of International and Public Affairs, which is part of Brown University, their study that was put out. It contradicts the Pentagon's official estimate, which says that, okay, $1.52 trillion was spent on the quote unquote global war on terror. But I think that even this Brown University study might actually undercount the amount of money that's being spent, because it includes, unlike the Pentagon, spending by Homeland Security and the Departments of Defense and Veterans Affairs. They leave out, apparently, the Department of Energy, which manages the country's nuclear arsenal. Ted, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, and also, let's not, I think we need to end on a reminder of exactly what the global war on terror is. For the most part, it's the United States using arms and money to prop up authoritarian dictatorships around the world and using them to attack revolutionaries who are trying to overthrow them, who in many cases are people whose values are closer to ours than the people they're trying to overthrow.
All right, that's all the time we have. We've been joined from New York by Ted Rawl, award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back. You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Trump administration is tightening the screws on the U.S. blockade of Cuba, prohibiting additional transactions in its drive to reverse the thaw in U.S.-Cuban relations that began at the end of the Obama presidency. We are joined from Montreal by Arnold August. He is a lecturer, journalist, and author of the book Cuba-U.S. Relations, Obama and Beyond. Welcome back, Arnold.
Thank you very much. Great to be with you once again.
Thank you for joining. So tell us about these new measures that were just announced by the Trump administration. What additional prohibitions does it place on U.S. residents and institutions?
Yes, of course, it is, as you say, it's definitely tightening the screws, with regards to the Cuba. And specifically, it is mainly with regards to travel. In the U.S. Department of Treasury, they have indicated openly in this declaration that came out yesterday, quoting from the Treasury Secretary Stephen Mnuchin, quote, "We have strengthened our Cuban policy to channel economic activity away from the Cuban military and to encourage the government to move toward greater political and economic freedom for the Cuban people." Of course, this has always been, the American policy towards Cuba, even under Obama. But however, this is definitely a major new offensive by the Trump administration against Cuba with regards to trade, and I think especially with regard to travel. And it's quite interesting to note that in the State Department, as a corollary with the Department of the Treasury, they have actually a list of 179 entities in Cuba, which is now, starting from today, illegal for American citizens to do trade with these entities. And it's quite an impressive list. When I first saw this statement by the Treasury and State Departments yesterday, I said to myself, oh, this is great. These were supposed to have been published in around September, but it's coming out 2 months later. So I said to myself, oh, that's great. There must be some contradictions within the Trump administration, and thus it took 2 months more to work it out. But when going into it in detail, it's quite the opposite. It took so much time because the list is so exhaustive. It includes just about everything that they could try to say belongs to either the defense or to national security of Cuba, 179. And looking into the list there, just in Havana alone, there are 27 hotels that have been included in this list of 179. And say, if you take one resort area, Varadero, there are 13. So this is very, quite a stringent list. And what I think we have to take into account is this came out this morning, is that Josefina Vidal, who is the head of the American desk, U.S. desk at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Havana, she says in her statement that this list is very arbitrary. I'm quoting for translating rapidly from Spanish. It is very arbitrary and the list is unfounded in the sense that it includes entities that have nothing at all to do with defense and national security. So it's quite obvious that many of this long list has been fabricated to a certain extent, to a sense that it goes beyond their own statement that they want to deal only with the military and military and security in terms of restraining the capacity of the United States to do business with Cuba.
You're listening to the voice of Arnold August. He is a lecturer, journalist, and the author of a new book, Cuba, U.S. Relations, Obama and Beyond. Arnold, I'm also looking at Josefina Vidal's statement, or a translation of the statement. And just as you said, you know, she calls it arbitrary. She says it's part of President Donald Trump's campaign pledge to overturn rapprochement efforts initiated by his predecessor, Barack Obama. And she calls it an upsurge, close quote, of economic, commercial, and financial sanctions. I want to ask you, Arnold, whether you're surprised about this, because when we interviewed you back in, I don't remember when it was exactly, maybe June, Trump had gone to Miami. He made, a big, anti-Cuba speech, anti-Cuban Communist Party speech. He was with Marco Rubio. Your assessment at that time was that while he was going to talk from the right side of his mouth and talk hard against Cuba, that there were enough economic interests by different commercial sectors within the United States, including within Republican-held states, that it would be kind of like, a lot of smoke, but not too much fire. In other words, that's how I remember it anyway. Maybe I'm mischaracterizing your assessment. But looking back now, are you somewhat surprised?
I am, to a certain extent, surprised, because I did have that view a couple of months ago, and that is also what I expressed in my book that was recently released. But at the same time, I also said in my book, and I think I mentioned it to you, that even though this analysis may seem logical because of the powerful anti-blockade forces within the United States, at the same time, we know that Trump is very unpredictable. We never know what he can do, irrespective of, any logic. So, yes, I'm a bit surprised, but not entirely, because it's obvious in the last few months he has been towing the line of the hardliners against Cuba. Now, the question, we could ask ourselves the question, will he soften this in the coming months or even within the last couple of years of his mandate? I think it's worthwhile considering that. I don't I'm not sure whether it will happen, but looking at his position, complete turnabout on the position on China. During the election campaign, China was the mortal enemy, right? And now, yesterday in Beijing, and today once again, he actually said that no one could blame China for trading with the United States in the way it has done. So it's a complete turnabout. Now, can this happen with regards to Cuba? It's hard to say, but it's always possible. I think it depends to a certain extent on the domestic situation in the United States with regards to the hardliners in the Republican Party.
Well, a big difference too, it would seem to me, is that China and the United States are major trading partners. The U.S. capitalist corporations are deeply integrated into the Chinese market. As a matter of fact, the so-called trade imbalance between China and the United States, which is like $300 billion plus, a big part of that trade imbalance is actually U.S. companies going to China, setting up shop in China, employing labor in China, and then selling the finished products back to the United States with a made-in-China label on it. So as a consequence, Trump is under real pressure not to have a complete blow up with China. But Cuba doesn't, even if there are certain sectoral economic interests, especially in agriculture and a few others that have a deep interest in better relations and more trade with Cuba, it doesn't seem to me to be big enough so as to override what has been Trump's predilection, which has been to be so tough against Cuba and so tough against Obama's beginning, and it was just a beginning, and maybe it was never meant to go beyond a beginning of some sort of normalization with Cuba. In other words, it seems to me that I don't believe that Trump is going to shift back because, I mean, he could, as we all know, we don't have crystal balls, but it seems to me Cuba must be preparing now for a kind of worst case scenario. And in that worst case scenario of this sort of shutdown or upsurge, as Josefina said, of sanctions, what will Cuba do in response? What can they do?
I think even before these regulations were made public yesterday, Cuba has been working with other forces. For example, only about a week ago, a very important agreement was reached between the European Union and Cuba with regards to economic investments. And recently, Cuba announced $2 billion investments from other countries in Cuba, as well as there are many other such indications. For example, despite all of the attempts by Trump to block travel to Cuba, the number of visitors to Cuba has increased over the last, just for this year compared to the previous year. So Cuba, I think, they saw it coming, and they have been trying to work out economic relationship with other entities, other countries, and they're doing it, and it's actually succeeding. And of course, one cannot underestimate the American current attempt to squeeze Cuba into submission, which has been its policy since the 1960s. But at the same time, Cuba is used to it. And the question I guess we can raise is, will Cuba be able to economically ride this out until the next mandate, which may go to the Democrats, which would have a return to the Obama-type policy that while supporting the blockade, did not want to and does not want to increase the sanctions against Cuba. Can Cuba ride this out? It's hard to say because another 2 years left to go. And of course, we don't even know whether the Democrats will win in the next presidential election. But I think this situation is still unfolding, and we have to watch how it goes in the coming months and, even years.
Yeah, I mean, it does appear to be like a very heavy blow. And correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like the new measure is principally target the tourism industry. Tell us about the importance of tourism to the Cuban economy so that we can sort of assess if they will, in fact, be able to ride it out until there's some sort of shift in the political situation in the United States.
That's a good question, Walter. First of all, I think we have to mention the fact that it's not that well known, that tourism is the second source of income with regards to other countries in terms of international transactions. The first source is the incomes that the countries, receiving countries, to the Cuban doctors that are working in these countries. These countries have to pay the Cuban state for the work of the Cuban doctors, and part of this this income, of course, goes to the doctors, but an important part of it also is funneled back into the state to help the economy. Then, of course, after that, it is tourism. There's no doubt about it. But I think that the tourism, it will have to probably go back to the situation before Barack Obama's new opening, in which the United States was an important force in was not that important force before December 2014 with regards to travel to Cuba. But since then, it has become an important force. So it'll definitely hit the Cuban economy. At the same time, as I just mentioned, the facts show that the tourism industry is holding its own despite the very difficult situation. But it's definitely going to hit the tourist industry for the simple reason that this is the goal of the Trump administration, to hit Cuba's economy through the tourism industry by even inventing entities that are supposedly linked to the to defense and to national security, which they are not. So it definitely will have an effect on the Cuban economy. The Cuban economy already has problems. It had problems before the Irma hurricane hit Cuba. And of course, even though they recuperated from this hurricane disaster, it still requires now and in the future a massive amount of spending by the Cuban state to return to the situation that existed before the Irma hit Cuba. It definitely is going to be a very negative impact on the Cuban economy. There's no way one can avoid saying this.
We're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from Montreal, Canada, by Arnold August. He is a lecturer, journalist, and the author of a new book, Cuba, U.S. Relations, Obama, and Beyond. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we will be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back. You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou and joined in studio by our longtime host, Brian Becker. NATO is growing yet again. The alliance's defense ministers decided yesterday to create two new commands, including one focused on naval operations in the Atlantic. We are joined from Berlin by Rainer Braun. He is the co-president of the International Peace Bureau. Welcome, Rainer.
Hello, good evening.
So thank you so much for joining. Tell us about these two new commands that NATO is creating. What exactly will they be tasked with?
You know, it is the continuation of the politics of NATO of the last years. The main job of the new commands is to make the activities in the direction of the Russian border and against Russia more effective and enlarge these activities. This means more troops should go to the border between NATO and Russia, mainly the Polish border. There should be a new system of transporting munitions, people, and military constructions to the border to the east. There should be a new development of streets and of the ways how you can come so quick as possible to the east part of Germany and Poland. So it is a new construction of make the NATO more aggressive and more effective in their aggression. I think this is the background of the new command structure.
So Germany, where you are, appears to be hoping to host the Logistics Command. Tell us about the peace movement in Germany and how they're reacting to that.
You know, it was a loud no, because for what we need these logistical command, what we need, and this is a main point for our request to the new government, is we need new cooperative relations to Russia and to all East European countries. This means we need more discussions about common politics in Europe, about a new system of European security, which includes Russia, and a reduction of military purposes, military alliances, and above all, we need a disarmament process in Europe. It is impossible that Germany and the other European countries will follow the line of NATO to enlarge the military spending to 2% of the GDP. That is absolutely the opposition we need. We need disarmament. We need the money for the social and ecological needs in our countries and in Europe. You know, 27% of our young people till 10 on one side and between 18 and 21 are poor people. They have not the possibility for an equal and for a correct development of their own lives. For that, we need the money. So we don't need these stupid logistical command. It is one point more in the way of militarization of Europe, and this is definitely the absolutely wrong way.
It's important. This is Brian Becker here, but you know, for the audience to remember that a lot of the NATO fighting in the last 15 years has been what would be called out of area. In other words, not in Europe, not in the North Atlantic. It's been in Afghanistan, in Libya. This seems to be a reorientation towards Europe. It's about how to get troops across the Atlantic, meaning American troops, to Europe, and how to get those troops across Europe, meaning towards the East. A major reorientation militarily towards Europe and consequently towards Russia. In the Pentagon's quadrennial report, which I believe came out in 2014, the same year that ISIS captured Mosul, declared Raqqa to be the caliphate of in eastern Syria, the caliphate of the so-called ISIS, the Islamic State. In that same report, the quadrennial report, now this was under Obama and just following Hillary Clinton being Secretary of State, they identified Russia as the number one threat. It was before 2014 as the number one threat to U.S. interests. Why? I mean, does anyone actually believe that Russia is threatening the United States or even the United States sort of hegemonic assertions anywhere in the world? It doesn't seem that way to me.
You know, we can ask, is Russia threatening Europe? You know, we can look for the figures. NATO is spending about $800 billion per year for military purposes. Russia is this year spending between 60 and 65 billion, one-tenth. So who is aggressive against whom? That is a very clear question. The figures are obviously, when you are looking for the modernization of the army structures, you have a partly modernized Russian army, but only partly. And you have a totally new army parts and new modernized armies of the NATO countries in all over Europe. You know, we are coming back to the highest period of the Cold War with aggressions of the West against the Soviet Union. The biggest change is that now the troops of the NATO is standing at the border of Russia. They are 250 miles or 200 miles away from St. Petersburg. So there is no empty zone like it was in the Cold War area between the Soviet Union or now Russian border and the NATO alliance. And this makes the situation even more dangerous. Then we have the new missile defense system, which is a very aggressive system against Russia. We have the new NATO troops in Poland, in Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia, which is absolutely the border to Russia, which are making permanent missions and trainings in their new areas. So that is the situation we are confronted. We are coming back to a period we all believe would never come back to the period of the Cold War in Europe. And the new structure of NATO, the new command system, but also the new militarization of Europe, with the new so-called anchor armies all over Europe. They are a part of the militarization of politics, and this is more than dangerous.
You're listening to Rainer Braun. He's the co-president of the International Peace Bureau. We're talking to him from Berlin. You're listening to Loud and Clear. You can hear us every day, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and also at sputniknews.com. You can also subscribe to our podcast, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, so that the show is delivered to your phone or computer every day. Rainer, the situation that you mentioned, comparing now to, say, right after World War II or in the decades that followed, I think that's an extremely important point. And it kind of goes back to the actual genesis of the first Cold War. The Soviet Red Army liberated Eastern and Central European countries from the scourge of Nazism and fascism. It was the Red Army largely that liberated the death camps, the concentration camps. Britain and the United States only opened up the Western Front in 1944. Up until that time, Russia, Soviet Union, had been doing almost all of the fighting against Nazism in Europe. It faced off against 80% of the divisions of the German divisions before launching that huge military counteroffensive that broke the back of the German Nazi establishment. After World War II, I believe that the Soviet leadership, the Stalin leadership at that time, wanted mainly to have Eastern and Central Europe function as neutral, as a neutral zone. They didn't immediately try to create socialist governments in those areas. They didn't immediately try to bring the communist parties to political power in the first years, 46, 47. That started more in 1948. When I think the Soviet leadership realized that there couldn't be a neutral Eastern and Central Europe, that they had to have allied governments, not neutral governments, which turned out to be a fantasy. You know, there was no neutrality. Now we have the end of the Soviet Union in 1991. The Eastern European countries, which were part of the Warsaw Pact, are now independent countries. And immediately that space did get taken up again by NATO. So it's sort of going back to the worst fears that the Soviets had at the very end of World War II, the fears that I think actually created the face-off in Eastern and Central Europe that gave rise to NATO and gave rise to the Warsaw Pact. Well, anyway, do you see it that way?
You know, I have some points which I would like to discuss. These are some historical points. What were the goals and the aims of the Soviet Union after 45? You know, I absolutely agree that in the minimum, they were in favor of a neutral Germany, a unified neutral Germany. And I'm a little bit in doubt about the East European countries. I think with the Red Army, they were really trying to occupy the power in these countries for the Communist Party or for parties which are strongly connected to the Soviet Union system. Look to the Communist Party in Poland and others. But what is definitely true, the main goal of Russia and the Soviet Union at that time was that they could be never be attacked again. They won't never be the situation like it was in 1812 under Napoleon, or like it was above all by the fascist occupation, but also by the aggression of the Germans in the First World War. So they would be, they really want to have their border secured, that no foreign attack was possible. And the best way to do it was to have open space between the so-called enemy in the middle of Europe or in West Europe and the Soviet Union. And this changed dramatically after the end of the Cold War with the weakness of the Russian power under Yeltsin. He was really destroying the country. This drunken guy was nothing else than a big supporter of the Western politics, and he was never fighting for the national Russian interests.
But Rainer, even at that time, the U.S. and the Western countries did give assurances, informal, and then later, I believe it was in 97, a guarantee of sorts that they would not take advantage even of Russia's weakened position by moving NATO troops further and further and further to the east and incorporating all of those former socialist bloc.
But frankly speaking, it was a lie, and they knew that they were speaking lies. You know, when you see the situation in 91, 92, when they promised at the beginning to Gorbachev in the last year no troops in Poland and no troops at the far more to the east than to the German border. It was a lie. In the same way, when they were speaking these words, they were preparing the NATO enlargement to the east. They were starting developing the discussion negotiations with Poland, the Baltic country, the Czech Republic. They were developing the first contracts between Poland and NATO. First, they were calling them only contracts of friendship. But these were the beginning and the start, and they knew this, for getting these countries into as a part of NATO. So what the U.S. and the main Western countries were playing after the end of the World War, of the Cold War wars, they were playing the role of winners. And winners can do what they want. This was what they were believing, and this was what they were doing. And this was the main job on the German side of Genscher and Kohl, and on the U.S. side, this was the job of Clinton. He was doing, and they knew what they were doing. And I'm absolutely sure when we will have in 5 or 10 years more documents free than we know now, this will underline the position of the Western countries that they immediately want to put Russia back so far as possible to the east. They have never forgotten or never given up that Russia was an enemy to the West.
Well, that's all the time we have. We've been joined from Berlin by Rainer Braun. Loud and Clear is going to be taking a vacation. We'll be off all of next week. We'll be bringing you the best of Loud and Clear from our shows during the past 2 years. We'll be back on Monday, November 20th. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here. We'll see you November 20th.
Loud and Clear. Thank you.